I get in there, it'll be the opposite end of the room. Pittsburgh. They're intentionally as far apart as they can possibly be, but you order you pick them out. It's a random seating arrangement, I know.
C-S-E-A-Y.
Oh, hey,
Yanni, Y-A-N-I. That's easy to pronounce, right? A-W-P-L-E. G. Graves.
Right.
Okay, so in case you haven't yet guessed, what Adrian is doing, thank you very much, Adrian, is handing out the written part of the what's up with your database. So I graded all the databases, wrote them into a text file, graded all the exams, and then I said, what am I going to do with this text file? So just carving it up in little strips, and we're taking them and handing them out. So you can staple it to your exam if you want. Okay. You're probably curious how to interpret your grade. So I'll give you a couple of clues. If you got 100, it's a gold grade. Right? So 12 people in class got a grade of 90 or better, and 3 people in class got a grade of 100. So where is it at? Those 12 people can just sort of skate the rest of the semester.
Because 8 plus 2.
This exam counts for more than the final, but you can do better on this exam. Now, for the remainder of the class, the final will count for more than this exam, but you can do better on the final.
Diana.
And about half of you have an opportunity to do better on the final. So there were 12 people that got 90 or higher, 3 people that got 80 or higher, 4 people that got under 18, 3 more people. 4 more people that got 70 or higher, 3 more people that got 50 or higher, and 5 more people that got 35 or higher. So the score is going to spread out. And what that does is that you have the opportunity to give more credit to the final simply by doing better on the final, except for those 3 people that got 100 that have lost that opportunity. And they will get more credit on the midterm. What's that? They can skip the final.
No, actually they can't.
Don't have to skip the final grade. But if you're looking at this and you're going, oh my God, I'm the one that got the 35, what do I do now? Well, that's a fact. Because you get the same amount of credit for your midterm as you got for your homework and quizzes. After filling out the last two quizzes. So if that's the final quiz, you got 100, or the lowest midterm quiz. If you got 100 there, 35 there, you got 135, divided by 2, right? Which is, I don't know what it is, 70 or something, right? So 15% of your grade, 30% of your grade now, is that 70%. Okay, anyway, so nothing here is uncorrectable. But on the other hand, if you've got whatever they need, it's time to come up with different strategies. Think about the material in different ways. A couple of 70, you probably want to come talk to me about the strategies that you're using. Okay? Actually, I didn't compute the distribution by score. The
scores for the one at the beginning, there were lots of people that got 30s, lots of people that got 20s, people who got 25s. The database was about, well, in fact, everybody that got 100 did perfectly on the database, and two other people did perfectly on the database. So the database question was about a 50-50, and everybody got something on the database. The lowest there was a 20. And the last question was the one where people had the most trouble. So there were a few people who got 25s, several people got 15s, and there were a lot of zeros and fives. So the loop kind of threw people for a
loop.
Okay. I won't try to make jokes about exams anymore. Questions? Yeah?
Would you be able to go over the JavaScript example?
Absolutely. In fact, the solutions are posted, but that's having posted solutions is not the same as having an understanding of the example, so let me run through the example. Oh, by the way, I should say the solutions are intended to be posted. I haven't actually checked it to see if I got the link correctly. And there was a second question?
Yeah, I got Merkoff and I have a query, but I do have a query.
Okay, good. So if you've got individual questions, come see me, and if I made a mistake in the grading, I did all the grading myself, so there's not any farming this out, go see so-and-so. If I made a mistake in the grading, I'll fix it immediately. If you call to my attention something I never thought of before, which probably won't be the case here, but I mean, it might be with something else, I'll take it and think about it and get back to you. But there's no problem at all asking, was this what I meant to grade? Haggling over whether this is worth 5 points or 10 points probably isn't a good thing. Okay. Let's see. Are the exams indeed there? Except we're not projectors. I just want to take a moment to boot up, so let me wave my hands for a moment. Do you have everybody has the exam in front of them?
Is the final going to be the same length?
No. So the final, you have two things that are different here. You have 2 hours to complete the final after we go over the process. So university standards for the final. So the final will be, this was a 45-minute exam for which you had for which you had an hour and 15 minutes. Trust me, I did it in 45. And the final will be a 1 hour exam for which you'll have 2 hours. So it'll be a little bit longer exam, right? But it won't be twice as long as an exam.
Will there be any other questions that are with the 50% of the exam?
It's hard for me to know because anytime there's a question that's close to 50% of the exam, it has some parts to it, as this one did. Did you get the tables right? Did you get the queries right? Did you get anything that looks like an access database in the system at all? So there's incremental grading possible for anything that has a large number of points. So question one had 30% of the whole exam in 3 questions. So I try to avoid all or nothing, 50-point questions, but grouping them sometimes is useful. Okay, so we got this. So this is two statements, right? You remember that a JavaScript program is just one darn thing after another, right? So it's sequentially executed. If you list the things sequentially, it just executes them sequentially, right? So the first statement begins here with four, and if you forget about the word wrapping, or the line wrapping, it goes four var I equals zero, semicolon, blah, 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 open brace, and there's the matching closed brace. Now inside it, there's an open brace here and a closed brace there. But the closed brace for this open is there, and so the beginning of this statement is here, and the end is here. That's the first statement. Okay? Make sense? The second statement, it's just written here on this line. Okay, so it does this first, and then it does this. Therefore, you can be pretty sure that the thing that it does second is whatever that says. Right? Now, what that says is, write onto the screen the thing inside the quotes, but not the quotes, which is the word liftoff, exclamation point, and then, because it's sending this HTML, it just puts a line break in. So it's an HTML line break. Okay, so that writes onto the screen, liftoff, exclamation point, with no space before it. So whatever has been written before that on the same line will appear immediately before the comma. With me so far? Okay, so we've reduced the entire problem of figuring out what's going to happen to figuring out what this does. Now, that's not normally the way you do it, but for pedantic reasons, it's easy to just kind of get that out of the way. And if you wrote liftoff all by itself, not if this then liftoff, but just liftoff. I mean, every single time this runs, it prints liftoff. So if you wrote liftoff, you got 5 points for knowing that whatever the heck this thing did, that did liftoff. Okay? And that occurred after this. Now, what does this say? Well, this says, do what's in here some number of times. So here's this is a cookbook for a loop, which says, define I to be a variable and set it initially to zero. You remember the equal sign is that assignment operator? So initially, I is zero. And then, before you run through this, check to see if I is less than 7, which it will be because it's less than 0. Correct? Because it's 0, so it's less than 7, right? So I is initially set to 0, so it's less than 7. So it passes the test. Now this part only gets done on separate, the second and third and fourth iterations. Doesn't get done at the beginning, so you can skip it. And then it says, okay, if it passes this test, so first it says my answer this way, then it checks the test. If it passes the test, it does whatever's in between here and here. Once, then it comes back up again. Instead of doing this, it does that, and then checks the fifth part. So the first time it checks this, and the second time it checks, it does that. Right? And this is an assignment statement, and this is an increment. So it simply takes I to 0, does this, then sets I to 1 more than it used to be, which in this case will set it to 1. And then it does this again, comes up again, sets it to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then when it sets it to 7, it checks to see if it's less than 7, and 7 is not less than 7, so it's done. And so then it comes down and does this. With me so far? So then the only question is, what's it doing here? And the answer is, sometimes it prints, and sometimes it doesn't. So when does it print? Well, it prints whenever this is true. Okay? So if this statement evaluates to true, this gets done. Now, when will this be true? Well, this asks the question, is I not equal to 3? So when I is equal to 0, 0 is not equal to 3, so it's true. You got to kind of screw your head around for it, but when I is equal to 0, 0 is not equal to 3, so if the question is 0 not equal to 3, the answer would be yes. 0 is not equal to 3. Okay? Okay. So if indeed I is not equal to 3, which the first time it surely will not be, because it's 0, then it writes I. I is what? 0. Okay. And then it adds to it, this is a concatenation operator for a string, a space, followed by dot, 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 followed by a space. So that will write 0, space, dot, 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 space, and the next thing that gets written will get written right after that. Because there's no VR. With me so far? Okay. So, then, we come down to here. That brings us back up to here. Here we increment I to 1. 1 still not equal to 3, it'll write 1, dot, dot, dot. Comes down 2. 2 is not equal to 3. 2, dot, dot, dot. Comes down 3 is equal to 3. Well, if I is not equal to 3, it says this, otherwise it does nothing. So it just sets it to 4. 4 is not equal to 3, so you get 0, 1, 2, 4, 5, 6. And after 6, it comes up here, increments it to 7, tests to see if it's 7. 7 is not less than 7, so it falls out. So it runs through the loop 7 times, numbered 0 through 6, and it doesn't print the third time. I'm sorry, it doesn't print the fourth time, numbered 3. Make sense?
How come it doesn't write list off where 3 would be?
Okay, so there are two things that are happening. First it does this, then it does this. Then it ends. This isn't inside the loop. This is outside the loop. So there are two things going on, whatever that is, and whatever this is. And this happens first, and then that happens. So that's why I started with the simple explanation. This happens second, and what it is it writes liftoff. So it always writes liftoff at the end of whatever spin it is. But it has no opportunity to write liftoff in the middle. There's nothing in the middle that would write liftoff. So these are just unrelated to each other. Except that happens, and then this happens. And this happens as a loop. It's like I told you to cook a souffle and then over here and make a sausage. And you do this one and then you're going to that one. The recipe has two things. And the first one has, you know, whipped fingers. Okay? Other questions? Okay. We'll talk over break about whether it's still season. So the solutions are all here. Including the solution to option B, which only one person selected. And it turned out it was easier to get option A right because you could just type it in the program. Okay, so if there are no further questions there, then we can return to... So there is more in the slides today than could possibly ever be accomplished. Down the entire remainder of the semester. So the idea now is not to run through that which you need to know to start the project, but rather that which you might want to think about as you're doing the project. So today's topic is human-computer interaction, but first I want to go back and talk about this mythical person month that we just put off every chance we got. And then at the end of this, we'll talk about project presentations. Now we'll actually land up stopping in the middle of this, and then we'll just reschedule the remaining materials for the later in the semester or something. So, remember the mythical man note that was a long time ago that you read it? The basic idea was that this fellow, his name's Fred Brooks, he's still teaching, or at least he was last time I saw him, at the University of North Carolina. And he's a computer science guy. And what he got called in to do was to fix what was turning out to be an enormous problem. Because in the early days of computers, the machines were complicated. They had like tubes in them that would burn out and have to be replaced. And they filled an entire room. And they required water-cooled air conditioners. They weren't even really air conditioners. They were water conditioners. Right. So the machines were very complicated. There weren't very many of them. And the people were very cheap. Because people didn't get paid a lot in the 1950s, and the machines cost a lot more than the people did. Right? So the programmers you just hire as many programmers as you needed to make this expensive machine work, right? That was the basic idea. Then what happens, the machines are getting cheaper, and the people are getting more expensive. And Brooks came along at about the point where this entire approach to doing business fell apart. So what happened was they were trying to build the most complicated computer program ever written, which was the operating system, like Windows, for the IBM 360, which was a machine that would run several computer programs at the same time. This was when all this virtual memory thing was first being tried out. So they were doing all sorts of things that had never been done before. And what they ended up doing was getting behind because they hadn't quite anticipated all the things that had to happen. So they added more people so that they could finish the project in the time that they had promised. Because they needed this operating system, quite literally, so they could fly people to the moon. So they didn't have a choice on delivering it later and making less money. That wasn't the deal. This was a pacing item in the Apollo program. And so, when they got behind, they did what you would normally do. They hired more programmers. At which point, they got further behind. Right? So, if you plot out the way programs like this work, you get, here's percent complete, and here's time. So time's going along, and what you promise is this, and this is 100% complete. So it got to 100% complete by some date. Okay. And then the project goes along, pretty much following that line, up until about 80%, and then it sort of levels off, and the project remains 85% complete forever. Right. Now you'll remember this picture when you're trying to describe what you accomplished in your semester project, right? Because you will have had some grand vision and you'll be charging up there, and then it'll turn out, well, the project's really bigger than you thought. And so what you'll do is you'll replan and restructure, and the replanning and restructuring doesn't speed you up, it slows you down. So this is what Brooks was writing about. So Brooks, after he did this, said, you know, I really need to write a book. I mean, you know, this is a fantastic experience, incredibly expensive, and if we're not going to keep repeating this, we better learn. So he developed this field of software engineering, of thinking about building software like you would build a bridge, right, the way an engineer would. So, now it's been some time since you read this, but do you remember what the key factors were that when you added more people tended to slow you down?
The training.
So you had to train the new people. And who trains the new people? The people that used to be programming. So their productivity went down, and then later you'd hope that everybody's productivity would go up. So you pay a little dip, and then the idea is, after a while, you recover. Okay, so that was one. Yeah?
More lines.
So, this was the biggest surprise to the whole thing. If I have three people on a team, how many people does each person need to talk to stay in touch?
Two.
Two, right? So I've got one person has to talk to two people, the other person has to talk to two people, a third person has to talk to two people. There are six talkings going on, but every talking has two people in it, so there are three possible lines, right? You can draw the picture. Those are the only directions that have to stay in touch, right? And what if you have a four-person team? How many lines will there be? Yeah, it's easy enough to draw, right? There'll be four. One, two, three, four, five. Six. Oh my God. Okay. So, you see what happened? We just added one person and we doubled the amount of communication. In fact, if we add one more, do you know what happens to the number of panels? It doubles again. So that one person has to talk to everybody. And those paths weren't there before, right? And if we add one more, what happens? Doubles again, right?
Do you know how many times you can put up with that doubling? Not very many, right? See the problem? That's why bureaucracies are hierarchical. Right? That's why the government's got a Department of the Interior and a Department of Labor, and then the Department of Labor has got a Bureau of Mines and whatever these things are, right? All these different pieces. Do they have a Bureau of Mines? There's a Bureau of Mines somewhere. Anyway, but that's why you organize hierarchically, to constrain those information flows. But you can't organize a software project hierarchically. You got a bunch of people that are working with something, everything talks to everything else. That's indeed why people came up with object-oriented programming later on. Okay, so, first I add more people and I pay a little price in training, and then it turns out my total productivity not only goes down in the beginning, it remains down forever. Because all these people now have to coordinate with each other. Right? So lots of software engineering revolves around constraining those communications. Now, how many people are on your project team? Not four? Three. Yeah, three. Not four. That's why. Right? Because four-person project teams are very difficult to do in grad school. Because you're managing all that communication in this class, and you're doing it again for another class, and you're doing it again for another class, and you might have a real job. Right? And you probably have other things you do in your life. So it just gets out of hand very quickly. So that's why three-person project teams are the largest you want to do, and they're also the smallest you want to do, because the amount of capacity is growing linearly. Right? So the communications complexity grows exponentially, the capacity grows linearly. You want to be somewhere near the bottom, but not at a zero-person team, right? They can't do anything. They're very easy communication. Right? So three is sort of a sweet spot there. That's why we do three-person teams. Okay, and you should take some of my other classes where we do six-person teams to see what a nightmare this can be, where we're trying to do really large projects. But those weren't the only two problems. Brooks encountered another problem that hadn't been well thought through. Remember what it was? He has this politically incorrect example. You remember the example? So, there are some tasks that you just cannot divide among multiple people because you have to do them in sequence. There are sequential constraints. Was this not in the reading? It's this horrid example he uses. I'll use the example, but forgive me. If it takes one woman 9 months to have a baby, how long will it take nine women?
9 months,
right? It's not a parallelizable task. Right? No matter how much communication you have, it's something that one person has to do. And that's the key to your project. If your projects are designed so that the second person can start on their stuff after the first person finishes their stuff, you've got a sequential constraint built in, right? If you want to get the productivity of three people, you have to select your tasks in a way that's parallelizable. So what would be an example of a good design and a bad design? Well, let's say you're building a website, and somebody has to do the sketch of what the hierarchy will be in the web pages, so that somebody else can then make a standard template for the pages, so that somebody else can then actually make a page. But the third person can't do anything until the second person's done. The second person can't do anything until the first person's done. Right? So those are sequentially constrained tasks. Maybe some of you who are nodding like this have your team set up that way now. An alternative would be somebody could go out and do data collection and work on the conceptual organization of the information without worrying about the layout on a page. Somebody else could do page layout, thinking about what the look and feel should be for the pages.
somebody else could be doing site design, which afterwards would have to have all the navigation stuff added to all the pages. Everybody else would just have this big fluffy navigation stuff in their examples. And now all three of those can go simultaneously, and then you can meet and find out that they don't quite fit together right. Everybody has to go back and do it over, but everybody is starting pretty far down the road. So now you can converge really quickly. So the first part of it was parallelized, and then the second part was sequential. You had to actually get together and then get this part done, that part done, the other part done. Right? So you parallelized early, and it was wasteful because you weren't well coordinated. So somebody might have found contents that actually couldn't be used, or somebody might have come up with site design that didn't match the logic of the content. But by working in parallel, you've gotten the whole group further than it would otherwise have been. Now, when you're working in a team, what is the most expensive thing you do? When doing nothing. Not doing nothing is actually cheap. Actually, that's a really good answer. It wasn't the answer I had in mind. Let's come back to that. Not just building software, which is where you're thinking, but just any time you're working in a team, what's the most expensive? Yeah.
Like planning what you're going to do, the initial.
Actually, that's among the cheapest. From this same sample. Okay, so the one I have in mind. Well, here, let me give you a quick example. I brought 40 people here last week, Thursday, Friday. We had a meeting. Anybody want to guess what it costs to have a meeting with 40 people? The cost of that meeting, just to run the meeting. We didn't have to pay anything for the facilities.
Is that a round number?
Yeah. You know the answer. You were there. What's the answer? That was half the cost.
I hope the answer is
people's
time.
Yes, that's the answer.
Time, right?
The most valuable thing, the highest spending rate you have, if you put dollars per minute on your time, is when everybody's spending their time simultaneously in a meeting. So a random meeting would have 40 people in it. We were spending $200 a minute to run that meeting because we had 40 people there. And if you figure out the value of their time and the cost of getting them there and getting them home, it's $120,000 amortized over 15 hours. $200 a minute. So if you have a three-person team and you spend, you've got 7 hours a week and you've got 7 weeks, so that's 49 times three people, 150 hours. Yeah? Yeah, 150 hours. If you spend 20 of those hours meeting, you've used up 60 of your hours. See the problem? So working side by side is fine. And you know, that can be very efficient. So team programming is a popular concept where both people are programming and one turns to the other and says, what do you do about this? That's a really good use of time. But having a meeting where one person's talking and two people are listening, that's a really bad use of time. So you want to minimize the amount of time that you spend spending at your highest rate. And you want to spend at the lowest rate as much as you can, which is where one person is productively doing something. So you want ways of coordinating the team that have a minimum number of interaction points that have to be coordinated. Okay, anyway, those are the basic ideas for what comes up. And then Turnetti has this rule of thumb that's now unique to software. And he says, no matter how much time you spend building it, you will spend half the total time testing. That can't possibly be true, right? I mean, if you would just think about it right the first time, build it right the first time, then you wouldn't have to spend all that time testing it. So why is it that Brooks is able to make this claim?
Because, especially for software development, you don't know what the right way is right away. You have to go through trial and error to figure out the problem.
And the reason why you have to do that is it's complicated. if it were relatively simple, you could see it all at once. But software exceeds the complexity that the human mind can grasp at one time. So you have to have some way of making abstractions and say, well, this will do this, and this will do that, and now I'll write this part to work with those. But of course, those don't really do the abstract thing. They do the concrete things. They actually do. And when you think about them in the abstract, you sort of gloss over all the things that, well, okay, so it doesn't print when there's three, but it prints most of the time, right? So you need to allow time for testing. Now, Brooks says you can minimize the time for testing by good planning. So he recommends that you allocate your time. One third for figuring out what you're doing. This is no longer quite what we do, but it's still good advice. One sixth for building it, and half your time for planning the tests. That might be something you haven't thought about. You're thinking, well, gee, can't I just test it after I build it? It's like, yes, but let's say that it doesn't do something it's supposed to. How will you know? Well, we'll try to make it do it and it won't work, right? Except, aren't you the person that didn't make it so it would do it in the first place? You're kind of like the worst person to try this. You're the one where that's your blind spot you're trying to find. Right? So you really want to give it to your friends and ask them to test it. And if you can do that, that's great. But what does your friend know about what you're trying to do? So you want to give your friend a plan. Say, here, do this with it, do that with it, and then let them try. So that's what test like. So, now look at the implications. How many weeks are there between now and the end of the semester? Round numbers, six? Okay. How many weeks for figuring out what you're going to do? How many weeks for testing it after you screw it up? Three. How many weeks for actually doing it? How many of you thought when you walked into class that what you really had was about 4 weeks for doing it, and maybe a couple of weeks for testing it and writing the result? You thought you had 6 weeks for doing it, right? And maybe you would test it the night before and see if it worked. That's probably what you were thinking, right? So if I told you you had only 1 week to do your project, would you have chosen a project of a different scope? This suggests that most of you probably have in mind projects that are more ambitious than you could possibly do, which are really great projects to learn with. So you don't have to do your projects perfectly. But you do have to, once you realize that you were a little too ambitious, figure out how to carve them back in a way that preserves your learning objective without driving you nuts.
Is this something like testing throughout the entire process constantly?
Well, so testing comes in several levels. So I can test components, and I can test the whole thing. Right? So certainly I should test the components to see if they work together. Like, I mean, gosh, you all came up with the most creative ways of getting big fonts. I mean, there are only two ways of getting italics, but there are like 217 ways of getting things to be big. And I think all of them were tried. And three things were tried that wouldn't make things big. And so how did I know what would make things big? Well, I had to go test them all. Right? So whatever bizarre way of making things big you came up with, semicolon really going out there? I go test it and find out if it worked with the semicolon. So that sort of thing, where you're building a piece and you can see the whole piece in front of you, that kind of testing is part of implementation. So this is about what happens after it's all built and goes together. Now obviously the bigger the project, the more surprises you're going to have at testing time. So you may get away with something like one-third, one-third, one-third. And, well, it's not perfect at the end, but both of you learn. That'll be fine. So don't take this too seriously. But do remember it when it turns around and bites you at the end. Now, the thing that's not quite right about this is the one-third for specification. Because if you specify something really well, and then you build it, you will eventually figure out that wasn't what you wanted. And when will you know that? After you build it. There's this endless saying, did you know Harry Carey, Chicago Cubs? Yeah, so when they turned the lights on in Wrigley Field, he did the play-by-play. No, they did the play-by-play for the first time the lights on. They go, no, I wanted a fun one. Anyway, making commercials with the doctor. So that sort of moment will happen to you as you're building this. You're like, oh, no, I know what we should have done. And so the trick is, instead of building your entire project in one shot to build the wrong thing very well, what you do is you build the project completely in a week. So the deal is, if you only have a week to build it, and it's going to be this week, build it the first week. And then you can throw it away and say, that's not what I wanted. I wanted this other thing. So actually go build that the second week. You look at that and say, hey, this is getting pretty close, but really it's not very well organized. Let's go build the right thing. We'll splurge. We'll take 2 weeks to build it. Right? So this is what professional programmers actually do. They just get out a little sort of computer equivalent of baling wire and bubble gum and kind of get something that looks about right, and they look at it and figure out what it is they really want. Do it again the next week. Bring it to people and show them. Say, what do you think about this? Let me tell you a little story about it. Get the reactions. Throw it away. Go to the next one. Right? So, it's better, we've learned since Brooks, if you will build a little design, build a little design, build a little design. And pretty quickly you start build a little design, a little build a little test, a little design, a little. And that's what the cycle looks like. And then if it has to work, you know, on Pluto at midnight, well, think of it as a prototype and give it to somebody that can then do one of these. All right, so this rapid prototyping cycle is a better approach than to just try to imagine it perfectly the first time. Questions? Okay, so that's the mythical person. That reading is the most remarked upon reading from 690 students at graduation. It's the thing people remember to the end. It's not the midterm. It's that reading. And the reason is, you're about to live the experience. And the reason there's a project in the class is not so that you can learn HTML. You could probably learn HTML without coming to class and being in the project group. But it's so that you can learn that experience, because for the rest of your career, you'll be using products that were built in this way. And some of you will be working with people who are building them, and a few of you will be in the midst of teams that are building them. Maybe either building them yourselves, or working with the customer and turning around and working with the technical people and saying, this is what they're really trying to say. So being the person that's showing them what's going on. So the hard part of this is not getting the back end to work. If I want to get my network to work, I can build a network, and I can see if it does what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to get packets from here to there, or it's supposed to keep something secure, or whatever it is it's supposed to do, I can check to see if it does. The hard part is building systems people can use, because you've probably already figured out the machine kind of has its own logic, and that's not the logic of the real world. That's not the way in which things normally work. And so you have to start thinking differently when you encounter these machines. There's a great case study that's later in the slide. There it is. Caller calls up, hi, is this tech support? Yes, can I help you? The compiler on my PC is broken, and it's still within warranty. I'd like it fixed. Some people have heard this already. So did you know PCs have cup holders? You ever tried to push the little button and have the cup holder come out? Yeah? Okay, anyway, you get the idea. People have in their mind an experience in the world. They see something, they associate it with their experience in the world, and they behave as if their associations are correct. And when they turn out not to be, they end up very confused. Okay, so the trick is, how do you accommodate this? Well, the original idea was you simply take the people and you make them more like the computer. Right, that's what all that JavaScript programming was, right? The computer has to have it specified very precisely, so we'll specify it very precisely. We'll just teach the human to think the way the computer does, and then we'll be done, because the computer's not very adaptable. The human's very adaptable, so that'll work. So, what you're really trying to do is you're trying to build a team. It's a team between the computer and the human. And so anytime you try to build a team, you try to figure out what people are good at. You know, so if you got 10 kids and you're going to make a football team, they're looking to see who can throw a ball. And it'd be better if they were the quarterback. Right? And you look at who's really big. It'd probably be better if they were like the linebacker or something. Right? And if you look at who can run really fast, it'd be nice if they were the wide receiver. Right? So if we're going to have a team that's going to be a human and a computer, it'd be nice to know what they're each good at. So that's where we start. So what are humans good at? Well, they're just handy at recognizing patterns. I mean, I can just tell you a sequence of numbers, and you can guess what the next number is, right? 2, 4, 6, 8, right? You know pretty well. It's kind of hard to write a computer program that would do that as well as you just did. Right, because I could have given it all sorts of bizarre patterns, and you would have gotten, you know, how about 3, 1, 4, 1, 5? That's 9, but anyway, close. You're going 1, 4, 1, 5, 9, 2, 6. Okay. Anyway, people are, some question, good at recognizing patterns. Okay, so if I show you a pattern on the screen, people are just dandy at seeing it, whereas if I put the pattern into the computer, it doesn't have nearly the kind of pattern recognition capability you need. I have to tell it exactly what kind of a pattern you look for. But people are very adaptable. That's why visualization is so powerful. People are also good at reasoning based on what's happened before to predict what will happen next. Right? So, for example, most of you have been alive for more than 21 years. On how many of those days has the sun come up in the morning? All of them, right? So you're pretty good at guessing what will happen tomorrow morning, right? I mean, if the sun didn't come up, you would be really surprised. The computer has no a priori notion of whether the sun is likely to come up tomorrow. For all it knows, it's got to the end of the clock period, and something different will happen tomorrow, right? So people are very good at looking at what's happened experientially and reasoning. They can reason inductively, they can see what's coming next, or they can reason abductively. They can look at lots of examples and see the big picture. They can, so for example, they can see things like New York and Washington and San Francisco. They can say things like continents, even though nobody's ever seen a continent. But they have sort of have the idea of really big island, water on both sides, right? How do I know? Well, I was over here last Tuesday, and there was water, and I'm going to be over there next Thursday, and there's water, and every time I looked out the window, there was land. Now, I don't know what was happening when I wasn't looking out the window, but I can sort of fill it in, right? People are good at filling it in and making a generalization. People are really good at communicating multiple channels. How many people have watched the video of the class? This number is always way higher after the midterm. So, in the video of the class, what do you have? You've got the camera pointed at the screen, you've got my voice, and nothing else. But here, you just nodded. When you type, I get feedback. I know I said something interesting. I might not have been true, but it was interesting, right? I can tell that it's interesting. I can tell what I'm saying right now is totally uninteresting because nobody's typing. Right? So I get auditory feedback that you're not intending to send to me. But I'm really good at that. When all of you are confused, I couldn't begin to tell you how it is I know that. I just have this sense that I shouldn't have come to school today. Right? When we're very tired or stressed, I can sort of sense these things. When I'm a little stressed, you can sense these things. If there's an exam coming up, you probably get it postponed, right? So, we're very good at communicating with multiple channels. Computers are terrible at that. Computers are like ones and zeros. They're like, well, hey, look, I thought it was pretty good when I got the screen to light up. You want me to make noise too? Want me to make noise that synchronizes with what's going on the screen? That's a really complicated programming problem, right? We talked about this multimedia synchronization. Humans, I mean, it's hard to, you know, tie our hands behind our back, make us stand in one place, have us not use tonality, right? It's just humans are bad at that. Humans cannot slow down. But the machine starts out slowed down. It starts out very focused on one channel. You have to sort of bring it up to talk to the whole human. Humans have multiple strategies. So if you're trying to solve a problem, if I told you that you had to get home tonight, and you're like, okay, I'll take the bus. I said, oh, actually, we're in code ultraviolet, and the buses aren't running. You're like, well, how far is it to get home? I wonder if I can hitch a ride. Do I have any friends that could take? But you never thought of that before. But you'd probably figure out a way to get home. Humans are really adaptable at finding multiple strategies. The problem, on the other hand, is like, I equals 0. Is 0 less than 7? Yes. Then we'll do this. I mean, it's going to do what it's programmed to do, no matter what. Code ultraviolet, code pink, it doesn't care. It's going to do whatever it's going to do. Okay. So, on the team, you want the human in control. Because the human is really good at controlling things. They can sense things, they can think things. They can react pretty well. Every once in a while, they do something stupid, but that's okay. They're paid for the computer. They're entitled to do something stupid, right? Okay, what's the machine good at? Well, it's pretty good at hearing dog whistles, which people can't do, but you can make dog whistles detected really easily. So it doesn't care whether it's a human-sensible thing or some machine-sensible thing. It'll get it either way if you buy an appropriate detector. As many of you found out in question number one, the one about 100 iterations in 10 milliseconds each, they're much better at calculations than people are, right? So they get the answer right, and they get it right quickly. So if you want to calculate something, you don't want the humans in there calculating stuff, that'd be nuts. So one that's really a big deal for what we do is they can get back information accurately. Now think about this. We had a talk today by a fellow from computer science who was talking about how the ability to reproduce information changed the way that people interact. It used to be that people would interact by having a conversation and constructing meaning between the two of them. But now, often that interaction is somebody talks, they broadcast it, many people listen, they think, put it together with their understanding of reality, and that's it. It's one way. So it's not that it's not a shared construction anymore, but it's not as balanced a construction. It's a one-way transmission that's coming from this dissemination process, as opposed to what we would have done one-on-one by ourselves. So computers are just great for facilitating that sort of thing, because they can reproduce information very accurately in many places. And they're good at repetitive actions, they don't sleep. They work under heavy loads for extended periods. They're actually much better than people for a lot of things that you might be done. Okay. So here's the trick. We'll just get the people to do what they're good at. We'll get the computers to do what they're good at. And we'll try to use the strength of one to cover the weakness of the other. But that's not really going to work too well because there's stuff they're both bad at. But whether we're both good at something will just give us the skew.
That's what's the future.
Okay, now, I'll talk you through a set of sort of general ideas. But I want to step back first and try to destroy the idea that we're trying to build one kind of thing. So you're making up a project for your Tech 90 class. If your project doesn't work, how many people will die? Okay. Now, they landed the space shuttle, like last week, in the dark at Cape Kennedy, a 3-mile-long runway, after coming out of orbit at 17,500 miles an hour. If the computer doesn't work, how many people are going to die? At least 7, and more if it hits something, right? The nuclear power plant down at Talbot Cliffs, which has got a bunch of computers controlling its operation, and, thankfully, some non-computerized backups. If the computer fails, how many people are going to die? Hopefully nobody, if the backup systems work, but we'd rather not find out, right? Because it could be a large number. So there are some things that are life-critical. And for those, you spend an enormous amount of money getting it right. You run design iterations where when the computer equipment doesn't work, you don't just replace the computer equipment, you replace the entire airplane it's in. Right. And so design iterations run over the scale of decades until you get it right. Right. So if you think about the evolution of cars, the evolution of airplanes, those sorts of things, there's just a tremendous amount of money that gets spent on life-critical applications. If I have a custom application for my business, let's say I'm the Social Security Administration, and I want to enter Social Security information, earning statements and things like that, I want the darn thing to be accurate, and I want it to be fast, so I don't have to hire a lot of people. And I'll pay any amount of money you want for that, not nearly as much as I would pay for that. So, pay a large amount of money for it. You build it for me, nobody else will use it, and when we don't need the Social Security Administration anymore, we'll just throw it away. It has no other purpose. This is the one that you're most used to. Just ordinary office automation software. The trick here is you have to be able to learn it easily. In the custom commercial one, you didn't have to be able to learn it easily. I could teach you. I only had 20 people. I had to know how to run this thing. If I made it better, I might only need 10 people to know how to run it. So I can afford to invest in training. But here, you have to be able to learn it by yourself. And of course, if you don't like it, I might go out of business. Somebody else might get into business for me. So we saw lots of things like WordPerfect that didn't capture the market, and Word that did. So you're looking at what is it that's making it easy to learn, what is it that's filling a niche, what is it that connects to some other capability that you need, who's got the lowest cost product, that sort of thing. Okay. And then those three together don't cover the whole spectrum. So if you're an artist, I might give you something like Photoshop, or something much fancier than Photoshop. If you're a musician, I might give you something that allows you to do music and coordinate your music with light shows or something like that. It's not even clear what it would mean to do that right. I mean, it's a creative act in the first place, so the act of creating the software is itself creative. And so that's really a different market from any of those. Okay. Now that's the application. Now if we think about the user, what single characteristic would you say most defines computer programs? What's that? Oh, right-handed, over 50, female. What's that?
They like to solve problems.
They like to solve problems. And at least until recently in our society, they tended to be fairly young. They tended to be the sort of early adopters. So, I mean, my mother's not taken up programming yet. Right? I wouldn't be surprised if my brother took them from me. So they tend to be younger. And thus they tend to have better eyesight. And they tend to create programs for people with good eyesight, because when they're thinking about people, what do they think about? People like them. Well, it's the only thing they know, right? Okay. So people vary an awful lot of ways. Okay, I'll show you another example. Until quite recently, the people who did this were mostly in the United States. And so they would create trash can items that look like this. And everybody knows that's a trash can. Well, actually, not everybody knows that's a trash can. That's what trash cans look like around here. Actually, they don't look like that around anymore, but people have seen them. But there are plenty of places in the world where trash cans have never looked like that. And therefore, you build a system that's got a trash can icon like that, people look at it and go, what the heck is this? Apparently, someday even had a problem with the mail icon, you know, where you get your email. So people have never seen a mailbox like that in New York, right? There just aren't any mailboxes like that. Oh, here are a couple of other good ones. So everybody knows red means danger, right? Except there are some societies where red is like good. Yeah, okay, that wouldn't be good then to you. Anyway, you get the idea, right? I mean, there are all sorts of these weird things, like, you know, I learned righty, tighty, lefty, loosey for, you know, which way to turn a knob to if you wanted water to come out. That just doesn't work some places. It's exactly backwards. Okay, so you need to actually study the characteristics of the user. You need to think about the characteristics of the user when you're trying to do this. Now, who is it that we're trying to get to study users? Who is it that needs to understand this? The programmer. And how is it that you choose to become a programmer? If you're interested in machines, right? So you can see where the problem is going to come in here. Is that these people don't sit around and think, you know, hey, I could learn more about new kinds of people. That's not what they do in the morning when they get up. They turn on the machine and they start writing programs. Right? So you're going to have somebody else, somebody who's not a programmer, who actually likes people, who thinks about the problem, thinks about how it should be done, and then sits down with the programmers and says, why don't we do it this way? Right? And so you land up with teams that have designers on them, and implementers, and a process for them to talk. You'd be really well advised to think about what that looks like inside your project team. Because probably there are more minor variations of those same differences. People that are very intuitive and good at design, people that are very detail-oriented to make things work. And neither one of them is going to be enough by itself. So you're really better off if you have a team that has both. Okay, anyway, there are all these differences on the user side that you need to think about. Which ones are you going to try to serve? Are you going to try to serve unsighted users? Well, I don't know, it's 1 or 2% of the population. If you're in it to make money, maybe not. If you're in it to serve society, maybe so. If you're in it to serve that niche of the market, yes, for sure. So here's the key picture from the day. You guys need a break before the key picture from the day? Sure. Good answer. We'll take a break.
Okay. Oh, absolutely. And maybe it really does.
Yes.
But the thing that they make a bad idea is if you have things that are going to cost them money to buy, then the chance that they're going to pass it from one webmaster to another and pay the money for each one to get it, and keep up with the changes from software as well. So if you find a free solution, then they're much more likely to get it. So that's the only
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so there was one question on grade. Since it was about the exam, I thought I'd just start by answering that. So the question was, if it takes 10 milliseconds, which is 10 1,000ths of a second, for a disk access, how long does it take to do, how many disk accesses can you do in a second? That was the question, right? That was the question, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
No. What was the question? Okay, so then the question is, how long does it take to access the hard drive? And the answer to that is, it depends on whether you pay a lot of money for your hard drive, right?
Well, right.
So some people used 10 milliseconds,
right.
And some people used 17 milliseconds, and some people used 20 milliseconds. 17 and 10 I'd actually seen before. 20 I was willing to take as rounding off 10. A whole lot of people use 1 millisecond, which I thought was a really impressive measure. I've never seen one measure like that. And so someplace around 10 milliseconds would be a good hard drive. What's that?
Well, I had that part.
Okay. And then that's how many 10 milliseconds are there in a second? 100 of them. And then there were some people that were really iffy on the, you know, they just wanted to make sure they didn't lose any points at all, and they said, so if you want to do less than a second, it'd be 99. But I was willing to take on. Or 50, you know, or something like that. Anyway, that's what's up. Was that the answer? That was the answering.
Well, actually, it's not, because it's 99.
Yes.
That's
correct. But it's close enough. Okay, so yeah, the answer does say 100, but it's really not. You get full credit for 99. If you said 99, you get full credit.
No, I said 900.
Okay. Okay, so Rebecca was working during the first hour of class to integrate the exam grades into the spreadsheet. And as long as she was doing that, I said, would you just please project what grade everyone will get in the class so that, you know, we don't have to worry in the rest of the semester. Right? So here's how the projection is done. Let's just say that your final exam grade is exactly the same as your midterm grade. That turns out actually to be a reasonable predictor. Right? It's not, I mean, you know, some people's grades go up, some people's grades go down, but many people who did well on the midterm will do well on the final. So, if that's the case, then we just need a way of predicting your project grade. So I said, let's say that you do as well on your project as you did on your homework. Well, that was an opportunity where you had time to take as much time as you needed, stop and think about it, get help from other people. They're somewhat similar tasks. The project is more like the homework than it is like the exams. Exams are the and the project sort of comes from different points. Right? So if we just said, let's say your homework grade was your project grade. Actually, homework grades turn out to be a reasonably good predictor of project grades. Right? In that people who do well on the homework tend to do well on the project. So then what would happen? Well, this line of 90 is an A. Now I used to have this discussion with students that said, well, but what if nobody gets a 90? And it's like, well, then nobody got an A. That's pretty easy, right? And they're like, no, can you grade us on a curve? And I'm like, no. For the first 5 years, I graded people on a curve. And every semester, my school library media specialist students would take me out behind the woodshed and explain to me why grading people on a curve and asking them to work on a team project was not necessarily a very smart thing to do. Right? Because you have the grading criteria set up against
the learning method. So no, I were rated to an absolute level. I finally learned something from learning theory. Okay. Anyway, so it would turn out that more than half the people in the class would receive a grade of A. Then, this range here would be the grade of B. And this range here would be the grade of C. So it's really easy to look at your exam and go, oh my god, a 26! Right? Without realizing I was on just one question. No, just but still, and a 25-point question, that average in with lots of things on which you already have demonstrated good performance. So it's reasonable to expect that your course grades would be higher. Now, it's an interesting question, what's the consequence of that? Okay? The consequence of that is none too harsh. You just get the pleasure of the course again. Right? So if you get a grade of B minus or better in all four of your core courses, then you're fine with the core courses, you're done with that, you can go off and do other things in the program. Otherwise, at some point in the program, you get the opportunity to reflect. It is exceedingly rare for somebody to take two shots at this and not get above there. And in fact, it's really rare. I can think of one semester when I had two students who were below a grade of A, or whatever the equivalent of grade at the time. So it's a rare event. That mitigated at least a little bit the concerns from earlier when you saw the raw number, not averaged in with anything. This is just spreadsheet magic. You can assume you do twice as well in the final, or, you've got all the variables. Okay? But it's an absolute target you're shooting for. Okay. Back to the fun. So this is the center of the entire universe of human-computer interaction. You have this human who's trying to figure out what the heck this machine is trying to tell them. And you have this machine which is trying to figure out what the heck this human is doing. Right? What does this person want done? So they're both trying to psych each other out. It's like there's a conversation going on between person and machine. Inside the human mind, we imagine that there's a mental model of the task that says, for example, if you want to make an airline reservation, first you have to decide where you want to go. Then you have to decide when you want to go. And you have to allow enough time for the airplane to fly there. And you have to be able to get to the airport at the time it leaves. So, if you're taking the metro has to be open. And all those things, right? So you've got a mental model of your task. The machine doesn't know all these things, but you do. So where does the task model live? In your mind. Right? And then you've got a mental model of the system. And that mental model of the system says, if I put my mouse over the thing that looks like this and I push this button, it will produce a list of flights. Because that's the fine flight button. Right? So that's an understanding of the operation of the software. And if you think about it, your mental model that you're using right now of the operation of the software that you're using right now is at a very high level. You're sitting here pushing buttons on the screen and words are appearing. Right? So you've got quite a high level model of what the machine's doing. I mean, word wraps occurring and all sorts of things. And you've got a model of the task. Like, which words should you write down so you can do well on the final? Okay. So, people have mental models of the task and mental models of the system, and it's like any tool-using problem. If you have a mental model of both, you have to figure out how to use the system to accomplish the task, right? Okay, so this is your world. This is the part you're very comfortable with. I've just drawn a little sketch of something that, if you thought about it, you might have sketched it in a similar way.
This is the weird one. The software's got two things in it. One is, it knows how to do its part of the task. So if you want to go from here to Cleveland on a Tuesday at 3 in the afternoon, it knows how to find flights from here to Cleveland Tuesday at 3 in the afternoon. It's got a database. So it's got a task model inside the software that's different from your task model. Your task model is big, high level. If you can't get from here to Cleveland, you're like, well, what's Cleveland near? Maybe I can rent a car and drive there. Right? Whereas the software, it's not like, well, I've never heard of Cleveland. I wonder where Cleveland is. What's Cleveland near? The software is not going to sit there and do it. Right? You either programmed it to do that or you didn't, but if you didn't, it's not going to do it. But it's also got a model of the user. So do you ever use Orbitz to do travel reservations? Next time you come back, it knows that you want to go from DWI and not from Dulles, because DWI is already filled in for you. Right?
Cookies.
What's that? Yeah, so it's using cookies. But what it's doing with the cookies is it's figuring out what you like and trying to give it to you. So if you seem to search for things from DWI, it'll offer you something from DWI. If you actually wanted to go from Dulles this time, you could tell it. Right? So it's making a model of you. Sometimes you specify these explicitly. Sometimes you configure something with a menu. Right? So, for example, safe search. If you want search done in a way that's child-friendly or family-friendly, then you leave safe search on. Otherwise, if you prefer, you can turn safe search off. Right? You made a conscious decision which one you wanted, and it then behaves in the way that you asked it to do. That's why cookies and things like that are used. So, the software has a model of the user, and the user has a model of the software. Okay. Then, these models talk to each other. Now notice, it's not that human talking to the computer, it's the thing in your mind. But for the thing in your mind to control the computer, you have to use things like your hands or your voice or whatever. So you've got some, this is a technical term, gazouta, and that becomes the computer's gazouta. You got it? Okay, good. So the gazouta is connected to the gazinta, which means that whatever it is you can produce, the computer can perceive. Now that's not quite true, because you could be sitting there and you could go, when the price comes up too high or something, and the computer's got no idea. So the computer has to build a specific gazinta for whichever gazouta you're going to use. And so one trick is to figure out how to use the kind of gazinta it's got to do what you want. These are technically called input devices. Okay. Then, the computer's got some gazettas, which are called output devices, you won't be surprised to learn, and they connect to your gazintas, and, of course, it only comes with certain ones. Okay. So what we have to do is we have to figure out, to get the whole thing done, the synergistic accomplishment of the grand task, you've got to build the task model into the software, you've got to build the appropriate user model into the software. The human has to have some way of getting the system model, this is really a big problem. The human has to know how to actually accomplish the task, the Turing problem, or not necessarily a human-computer interaction problem. And then all these things have to get used to talk between the two. Okay, so that's very reductionist, but that's really what's going on. That's all. Okay, now we'll put three slots. I got my mental model over there. Maybe we'll put three slots. Yep. So, really just one important point to make here. The mental model that the user has of the machine, it's not a model of the actual capabilities of the machine. It's a model of the user's
imagined machine that doesn't really exist. Some construction of the user's mind.
So, I hate to keep picking on my mother, but the good thing is my mother doesn't know how to watch the video.
But when my mother's searching for something, you know there are these two boxes that you can type the words into? The one in the middle of the screen or the one at the top of the screen? Right? She doesn't know the difference between the two. So she'll type URLs into the query box, and she'll type query terms into the search box. And so the web search engine company figured this out pretty quickly. And if what's typed into the URL box doesn't start with HTTP colon blah blah blah, just space in the middle, it gets passed automatically to a search engine, just to make my mom happy. And if you type the URL into the query box, it brings that URL up first in the search list, and then you can just click on it, so it works perfectly fine. That's really good design, because you would think that the proper thing to do would be to say, no, I'll do it this way. But that's actually a failure of design, when you have to explain to somebody how to do it. I mean, it's complicated if you have to explain how to do it. But with simple tasks, you want to have simple design, and if there's a box where you can type something in, and there's something you might type into the box. When you type the thing into the box, it ought to do the appropriate thing for which you type into the box. And it's the people who put some boxes there in the first place that you should ask, why did they do that when one box would have done? Okay. So it's not the user's understanding of the real machine. It's the user's understanding of the machine that doesn't actually necessarily exist. That's what the user is using. They're using what they think the machine does. Let's see a simple example of this. How many of you know more than half of the capabilities that Microsoft Word can do? All the things on the main. Nobody on the planet. I don't think the programmers who did this know more than half of it. Maybe that's why they have a team of programmers, right? Somebody did this one, somebody did that one. They must have conversations over coffee. Why did you put that in? Oh, Bill wanted that. Right? So, anyway, nobody knows how Microsoft Word actually works, but lots of people use it. Because they have a model that's good enough in their mind of what the thing does. Okay, so what happens? You get kind of a cycle. So, at some point, you have some goal. Your goal causes you to decide you want to do something. Once you decide what you want to do, you have some intention, you choose the way to do it. Which box will you type into? Once you choose what you're going to do, you actually do it. This occurs out in the physical world. All this rest of stuff happening up in your mind. Then, you do something, and you see what happens. Right? This is how you learn to drive a car, right? You drive, you're sitting here like this, you turn the wheel, nothing happens. You turn the wheel the other way, nothing happens. You push down the gas pedal, you hit the thing in front of you. Start to build up a model of what happens, right? The wheel does nothing, so the car is moving. Okay, makes sense after you see it. So, people will start out having a goal. They have no idea what to do for selection and execution, so we'll try something and we'll see what happens. Think about this when you design your project. The user who sits down in front of your system has no idea how to do what they want to do. You have to show them. It took years before I realized this. Yeah. This is one of the most beautiful interfaces you'll ever see, because there's nothing on it. I mean, what can you do here? You can type stuff into that box, right? What are you likely to do? Type stuff into that box. What should you do? Type stuff into that box. Now, think about the Yahoo homepage. Seven boxes, stuff flashing, text everywhere. They're both starting points.
which one will people behave properly from the perspective of the software layer? The one that gives you one choice. Okay, so when the user gets started, they got no clue what's going to happen over here. They're just going to do something and see what happens, and it ought to bring them closer to what it is they want to do. Then they'll perceive something, and they'll go around the cycle, and they'll try to convert. Notice, as they go around the cycle, they can change their goals. And you can actually see this happen if you look at web query logs. You see somebody looking for something, and then their task seems to drift, and they're off looking for something else. Because of what they learned. Now, there are other people who are just schizophrenic, and they're looking for something, and then they're doing something else, and then they're looking for something, and then they're doing something else. But there are, you can see very clearly this drift phenomenon, right? Where people wanted to do something, and then they're learning more about what it was they were doing. So if you think of this as a learning process, you'll be much better equipped to imagine what's going on in somebody else's. Okay, the HCI people just love these acronyms, right? So they tend to think when they're trying to design systems, what goals do the users have? What kind of operators should we provide to help them do that? What methods can we use inside the machine to do the thing? So my goal might be to back up my file system, my operator might be copy a file. My method might be read the bits off of here, write the bits onto there, and then the selection strategy is that might be drag and drop. Right? So then this gets called DOM. Right? It's actually one of the least memorable acronyms. So that's just a way of taking this picture and sticking four letters. Right? So they're into four letter words. Okay. What kind of input devices do we get? So you would naturally think, because you see it in front of you, about a keyboard, and that you're looking for the rest of the four-letter words. So they have the Windows icons, menus, and pointing devices. Yeah? And we have the contrast repetition of Latin part two. Okay, so in any case, you won't forget the principle. Okay, so you're familiar with keyboards. But those aren't the only ways of getting characters into the system. The other way to get characters into the system is to hold up the characters in front of the computer and have them read it. Right? So this is what you do when you scan something. Right? So you scan the text and you have it read the characters and convert it into characters inside the system. Or, I don't have to bring characters in, I can bring entire words in. So when I do speech recognition, I don't get all the characters out of the speech, I simply get the word. In fact, I don't even put a pause between my words. And we get them just fine with speech recognition. Right? You're able to understand the flow. So human language doesn't involve putting spaces between words as a natural part of the process. It's an added part to help with readability. And in fact, when we do handwriting recognition, we'll often recognize entire words, for example, in our sentence. Okay, so we can get in, text in with the keyboard or OCR, for characters, or we can get it in word at a time. But that's not the only way we can talk to this thing. So what you've gotten used to, what you've grown up with, are computers in which you can point and click. Right? This is the Windows icon mouse pointer, the WIMP paradigm, right? And so you are most probably familiar with a mouse or maybe a touchpad.
or a touch panel, you can touch the screen. When I flew in the Navy, we had a dead mouse. It was an upside down mouse with a little ball sticking up, and you could just sort of massage the ball, and that would cause the pointer to move around the screen. And so, and that was handy because then you didn't have to have a big flat space. So if you're stuck here in a little airplane, you could just move the ball around and have it move that way. So those give you 2D interactions, which is really handy because you have a two-dimensional screen in front of you. So for every place you put the mouse, there's some place where the pointer should then be on the screen, right? But you can also have 3D interactions. So you can get the 3D goggles, you know, that red and green, or you can flip one eye off, and then a 30th of a second later flip the other eye off. And now I've got one eye looking at the picture drawn one way, and the other eye looking at the picture drawn the other way, so it looks as if I've got three dimensions, but now I have to have a three-dimensional pointing device. So what you do is you get a 3D mouse. Now what's a 3D mouse? A 3D mouse is a magnet. And I take the magnet, and I move it around the space in front of my computer, and my computer monitor has got on it some magnetic sensors that sense where the magnet is in three-dimensional space. So this allows me then to make, for example, a wand. I just take a little magnet, stick it at the end of the wand, and then I can take the wand and point at this thing. Yeah. In fact, I can put one in each hand, and I can make whatever it is I want to pick up in the 3D space. I could reach in, grab it, and pick it up with a mouse in one hand and point at it with a mouse in the other hand. Right? And so people build 3D systems like this and they'll be fine. What's that? So anyway, those are a couple of ways. Another way you can do it is you can just have a camera looking at somebody, and then you can see if they gesture in a certain way. Right? So for example, if they raise their hand, you can detect people in a classroom who raise their hands automatically. You can not get the words that I'm saying, but you can figure out who I am. So when we do speech recognition, we take the words in, and we separate, or we take the sounds in, and we separate them, the sounds that are associated with the content, and there are sounds that are associated with who's saying it. So for example, if you get somebody from Alabama, they may talk in a different way than if you get somebody from New York, or somebody from the UK, even when they're saying the same thing. And what they're doing is they're using different phonemes, different ways of pronunciation, to say the same thing. And so we move the signals one way or another, and we can use it to automatically identify who's talking. We can also put a little 3D thing on your head and see which way you're looking. And so we can change the scene you see based on the direction you look. We simply take the monitor and we plaster them to the front of your eyeglasses. And then when you move your head, we just repaint the screen so that whatever it is you were supposed to have seen in that direction is what you see. Oh, and I have over in my other office a device where you can be sitting here watching the screen, and the screen is sitting here watching you. So it's a little dot on the screen that indicates where it is you're looking on the screen at any time. So instead of having to click on something, you can just, this is really bizarre, as well as you wish. You can just look at the thing and blink, and it'll focus. Okay. Yeah, so everyone thought we'd know the wrong thing. But the salesman, when they come give a demo for this, what they always do is they get some guy, they stick him in the center of the room, they got, you know, the thing set up, they get somebody with glasses on just to show that it works with glasses, you know, so they're doing all the technical stuff, and then they put up one of these advertising images. You know, this gal sitting here holding some beer. Right? And the way these things are set up is they're supposed to take your eye to a spot and then bring it out the arm to the beer. Right? That's so the advertisers think about this. And so they're like, see? The machine will rat on you. Okay. And I would say advertisers use those to figure out if their ad is doing exactly what they want it to do. Okay. So keyboards are patterned after typewriters. Do you know how typewriters got to be the way they were? I mean, why is it that typewriters say QWERTY? QWERTYUIOP.
Writer
on the first row,
and when people were going
door to door
field and
were
going to go sell typewriters, they
can
take it real fast.
Okay, so that explains why these things are up top. Why does it put the most commonly used letters like E over here, and the least commonly used letters like K, J over here?
Doesn't it just slow type it down?
Yes, because if you type too fast, it's easy to get stuck. Right? And so what we did was, since most people were right-handed, we would put the commonly used letters on the left hand in order to slow you down. Right? Because it's a mechanical device. Now, I will point out to you, you probably have noticed this already, this does not have a problem with the keys getting stuck. So in 1930, a fellow named Dvorak came up with a keyboard on which you can provably type some 30% faster. Well, because it didn't have all these things, it was designed to slow you down, drop into them. Right? And so why is it that our keyboards are QWERTY keyboards? I mean, you could say because Dvorak's hard to pronounce, but it's QWERTY.
That way, so that's what people know, so we're
going to
teach it that way.
Right. So it takes several hours to learn to type on a keyboard like this. And you couldn't get people to invest the time to learn a new keyboard once they'd already got known a previous keyboard. And so if you made a typewriter that had this keyboard, you couldn't sell it. Okay. And then since people who were going to learn to use computers knew how to type, the market got created for people to do how to type on the old keyboard. So you can actually, if you want to, you can set the computer on the other end. If you want to buy a bunch of labels, you know, reprogram your keyboard to do it. But of course, very few people do.
If European keyboard is different
than
the keyboard
needs. Yeah, so the European keyboard, they try to like stick some kind of a Z up here or something, just so that they know when the Americans are typing on them. No, but they've got all those extra characters that, you know, that and tilde in some countries, but other countries use the A with the dot dot. So different keyboards are different.
But the order of the letters is different as well.
The general order is the same, but they do a couple of funny, though, Z's and Y's are moved. So if you send an email on a European keyboard, you always have typos all over the place. But the European keyboards have a mode you can set that makes them work like an American
right,
keyboard, despite
yeah.
the fact that keys this way.
Right.
Just like you can make a keyboard into a Dvorak keyboard. If you want to. In fact, you all go home tonight, make your keyboards into Dvorak keyboards, and come back and report next week how many of you still have Dvorak keyboards at home. Okay. The number will be small, I predict. Okay. Okay, so going the other way, the senses that you're familiar with are your visual sense. So you can see things like where something is or how it's moving. So you're actually very good at seeing motion. Your eyes are optimized to see motion because if a saber-toothed tiger is coming towards you, it will be moving, right? And you'll perceive that. So there's survival value to detecting motion. So it's really easy to see. And of course, you can detect which colors there are, but people that don't think about this really go nuts on the colors. You know what the guideline is for how many different colors you should use on a screen? Four. Anything more than four starts to look very garish. So four colors is very helpful for sorting out different things, helping people to see it. Beyond four,
It's more like, hey, I learned how to set the color of the font.
So every character is a different color.
So you can also hear things. And just like it's hard to tell what an absolute color is, so one of the guys that was here last week, he wanted to know what color yellow National Airport was. So he went to Home Depot and he bought a bunch of color swatches and took them to National Airport, held them up against the wall in order to tell what color it was. Right? So if you want to know what tone something is, very few people have perfect pitch and can tell you, oh, that's a T-shirt. But an awful lot of people can tell you where the tone changed. They can tell you that the tone changed at that time, and then it went down. Right? So relative pitch and relative color, very easy for people. Perfect pitch, absolute pitch, is difficult. Anyway, you can get all these things in the auditory channel. So you buy a computer, you're going to get a visual channel, you're going to get an auditory channel. Right? You got speakers. But there are all these other senses we have. So for example, when I push at this table, it pushes back at me. That's how I know there's a table here. Right? Otherwise, how do I know that's my projection of a table, a picture of a table? Right? But I touch it, and it's there. So you can deal with computer devices that when you touch things, the things are actually there, even though they're not really. They push back at you. Right? So one way is with a glove that's got an exoskeleton on it. And so as you try to close your hands around something, once they're closed around it, it stops your hand from moving further. Right? So you actually feel as if you grabbed a physical object that's not there. Another way is to put an exoskeleton on your entire body, right? So that when you reach out and touch the table, you get something like that. And there are other ways of giving you the effect. One that I thought was really bizarre was they were training firefighters. And they wanted the firefighters to experience what it felt like to run into a fire. But starting fires is expensive. So what they did was they put the firefighter in the breathing apparatus, and then as the firefighter ran into the fire, instead of pumping oxygen in, they pumped smoky air in. So that sort of thing that would come around the corner of the oxygen mask that the firefighter would smell, that would give them the feeling of actually being there. The computer was sitting here stimulating the olfactory sense. Okay, and then if you really want to drive people nuts, you can send them to Disney World and pick them on a ride and actually move them around and make it feel like they're going through some sort of physical motion, because they are, not the actual physical motion. And this is what's done in flight simulators. So when you train pilots for what it's like to fly in bad weather or inclement conditions or something like that, they don't sit here at a table going, ooh, now we'll turn it off. But instead what they do is they pick them in something and go, bouncing all over the place and they're trying to keep the ready. Okay. Okay, anyway, so some of that fancier stuff starts to get to be virtual reality. What you're used to is the 2D direct manipulation graphical user interface. So direct manipulation, the objects on the screen represent the things that you are trying to manipulate. So for example, you'll see a picture of a document and it will represent a file, or you'll see a picture of a folder and it will represent and what we call a folder, but it's really a directory inside the computer, in the disk structure of the computer. And then you can pick up the file and drag it over to the folder, and that will be like putting a document into a file folder. But what's really happening in the back is it's copying the disk into the directory. So that's just one way of telling it to do something. You can also select things on a menu. So you could, for example, select an object, hit copy, go over to the place you want to put it, select it, and hit paste. And so that would be using menus rather than direct manipulation. Direct manipulation is an abstract representation of reality. And then you could also use things like the command line interface. Okay, so we're back to acronym number two. The normal way in which these interfaces are built
is with windows that you can drag around your screen, so the idea of resizing your windows and being able to have many of them up at a time is a relatively recent innovation. Icons that represent things, that don't allow direct manipulation. Menus that have a hierarchy defined on them. Now here's a question for you. If I could create a menu, should I put a lot of things in one pull-down menu, so it's a long menu? Or should I put something in some top-level categories, and you select which top-level category, and you get to see the next categories, and you get to see the next ones over. You've seen it done both ways, right? So which way is better? Which way is more usable? Which way is faster? What's that? The hierarchical organization?
When you see
everything. Yes, the one where you click and see everything. Why? Why is it better to see everything? Because the physical action, this is the GOMS perspective, right? There's the physical action the user takes is only one click. That's one. Do you remember? That's actually a really good point. Any others? So remember in the original picture of what was going on in people's minds. Remember this one? Where you had to have, you did something, and then you perceived what your situation was and went around again. Right? That perception action, when you can see everything, it's self-teaching. It shows you what the options are. Whereas if you had a hierarchical structure, you've been thinking from the perspective of, I knew what I wanted to do and I'm just trying to find it. But I just arrived at this thing. I didn't make the computer. I didn't make 690. How do I know what this thing does? Well, now it's kind of nice if I can find, if I can figure out how to get the menu, I can see everything. That's why direct manipulation beats menus, and menus that are shallow, that show you everything at once, are better than menus that are deep, that hide things at hierarchical levels of abstraction. You want to expose to the user what their options are so that they can make good choices.
Is that not what I'm supposed to be doing when you access the menu? That's sort of what, when setting up the interviews,
so it is an extremely good point, and one well worth making to the entire class, that you want multiple ways of doing things because the same person at different times will be thinking in different ways, and different people think in different ways. So people will think in ways different from the designers, and it's important for the designers to think, how would it make sense to get access to this? It's not clear to me that that's at odds with this point, which is that if the way I'm going to give you access is through a menu, I'm better off, all other things being equal, to show you everything at once than I am to give you a complex hierarchical structure to the menu. I'm better off, all other things being equal, to support drag and drop rather than to force you to use a menu. But that doesn't mean I wouldn't want to also allow you to use a menu. So in Windows, I can use a menu to drag, I can use a menu to cut and paste on a file and get the same effect as drag and drop. But cut and paste can do some things drag and drop can't, and drag and drop can do some things that cut and paste can't. Right? Like when you're connecting things in an access database, that's drag and drop, but cut and paste wouldn't be the right mental model there. Right? So it seems to me the right answer is that one of these is preferred over the other, but that doesn't mean that both wouldn't be preferred over just one.
When you're talking about the hierarchy of menus and how something that and how it's better to have multiple choices, how does that fit into the user coming in from that perspective? From that, at least on the first window that you see everything that your all your programs are visible or. go through a bunch of different stages to sort of get to a program.
So that would suggest the match the better design.
Right, but that's not necessarily true for some people.
So the PC has something where it tries to get the best of both worlds, where it hides the menu items that you haven't used recently, optional, and the thought there is that by getting some kind of an economy of screen space, you can focus attention. And there's a trade-off, because now I'm hiding options that might actually be the options that you need right now. So the PC is doing something that's trying to make the user experience better. The Mac's designed in one way, the PC without this function is designed a different way. So I find it awful that to get to a file on somebody else's computer, I have to go to programs, accessories, Windows Explorer. Because it's the way I learned first. I'm sure there's some easier way to do it, but it's the way I learned first, and it sticks with me. And so every time I get on somebody's computer, I then drag that thing to the desktop, which of course pisses them off because then it's gone from the place that they're used to. So I don't know how to draw the comparison of Macs and PCs, because every time I see a Mac, I get confused. Other questions or comments? Okay.
Well, let's see where we reach an actual stopping point, because there will be plenty of time for the discussion of your project. Let's stop here, and I will find a place later in the semester to fill in the rest of this. The thing to browse through, if you want to, is that at the end of this, as sort of a freebie, there's a section on information architecture. And these are a set of slides from Jimmy Lin. And they're here so that you can think about whether you want to take Jimmy Lin's information architecture course. So these are things that will very directly translate what we're talking about in human-computer interaction to the design of websites. Things like you need a static design and a dynamic design. There are different parts to the problem. Static design includes things like the overall layout of the site. This is where the layout guidelines. Then there are some standard sort of designs to use for the screen, so people are used to seeing navigation bars at the top, or navigation bars at the left, or maybe both, and related links on the right. So these are sort of stereotypical layouts that you can use. And you see them in places like the New York Times, where they put navigation at the top, right? And they lay out content in a grid. But then there's an interaction design problem, and it's a little like a chess game. How many people here play chess? So in chess, how do you decide what move to do first? What's that? Yeah, right. So there's a set of standard things to do first. I say opening, the beginning of the game. There's a set of standard books about good chess openings, right? So it's the part where you're starting from a known state, and so it's really easy to say what happens first. I mean, it's hard to say what happens in the middle, but it's really easy to say what happens first. And so the opening, you should get a lot of thought to. What happens at the beginning? What's the first experience a user has in your site? What do they do first? And then there's an end game. What are they trying to do? They want to buy a product? Okay, fine. Then I will have sold them a product. Right? So I'll have printed a receipt. Right? I know what I'm going to do at the end. And then the middle is where it kind of gets mushy. So the middle is the hard spot. But the mistake people make is they design to the middle without designing the beginning. And people don't get to the middle because they get to the beginning and I have no clue what to do. Okay. So. We'll talk about evaluation later on. There is an entire course in human-computer interaction. And the idea tonight has been, actually there are two courses. There's one course in design and evaluation, and one in implementation. So the entire idea tonight has been to give you an idea of what the basic issues are that you would study in such a course, and to give you some thought process for how to think about not how would you use your system, but how would your user use the system, and how would you go about making sure that the way that you've designed the system makes sense not to users like you, but to users like your users. Questions on anything from tonight? Okay, here's what I'd like to do. During the break, if you would come up and load any PowerPoint you wish to share. Have to show a PowerPoint? Great if you do. There is a cutesy place to plug in your USB hub, or, if you do it at a time, or you can FTP stuff, or you can bring stuff up over the web. But if you would save what you want to the desktop of this machine, then you can just ace by here quickly. There are 9 teams. If every team took 3 minutes, we'd be 27 minutes, and we will have 30 minutes. So it would be really good if every team took 2 minutes, and then had a minute to switch with the next team while taking questions. So we should always have the next team assembling, ready for questions. Okay? Time to break.
Yeah, but okay, that's the mountain. I'm very excited though.
Okay, so you're getting the full treatment this evening, not just the camera in the back of the room. The camera is actually zooming in on you, capturing the full dramatic impact of your... this was requested by Rebecca, who thought that it would be much more fun to sit at home and watch you guys do it than to come in and watch you do it at first, but she wanted to know what you're doing. Rebecca's not able to be with us. Okay, we're on.
It's up to you. All right, well, I'm starting anyway. Hi, I'm Mark Villa, and Heidi Hurd, Chris Steve. We're a team, and we're working on this, the Dreyfus Affairs, the Hidden Collection title. About the collection, a series of published writings, drawings, posters, and illustrated materials documenting the event known as the Dreyfus Affair in France in the late 19th century, were recently rediscovered at the special collections section of the Eisenhower Library at the Johns Hopkins University, where Heidi works. Quick background information on the Dreyfus Affair. Alfred Dreyfus, son of a wealthy Jewish Texan. Wealthy Jewish textile manufacturer and captain in the French army, was accused, tried, and convicted of treason for selling military secrets to Germany in the late 19th century. He was arrested, convicted, sentenced to imprisonment in Douglas Island off French Guiana. Trial based on insufficient evidence and just a whole lot of procedural mess ups. But because of the prevailing sense of anti-Semitism in France at the time, the percentage of the French population just sort of believed what the accusers were saying, and the verdict was seen as evidence of alleged disloyalty of French Jews. Dreyfus was exonerated in 1899. What we wanted to do, we wanted to create a website presenting digitized versions of some of these original pencil drawings, which were done by the French illustrator Louis Maltès. That's actually a pseudonym. I don't remember what his real name is on hand. But they include portraits of key figures such as Dreyfus himself, Emile Zola, who wrote the big Jacques article in the paper, responding to the trial. Displaying descriptions, captions, translations were necessary because pretty much everything in the collection is in French. And we're hoping to also present audio clips of the curator of the museum, perhaps describing some of what is in the materials. And we're hoping that this site will appeal to students of French history, cultural history, Jewish studies, et cetera.
And while the next group is setting up, you can take one question, but only if the next group is setting up. You could just do it in reverse order, whoever was last.
Okay.
And can we please get the group after that actually physically standing here, so we can not have a vote with your feet for who's going to be the group after.
So what's up, people? What are the language skills of the
federal? I'm Kim, and we are going to be revamping a web website for community theater in the hometown of Phil Wisconsin, which they desperately need, if you don't see in a moment. A teenager who's active member in the group decided to redo their website and then got too busy and it got stopped. And it's kind of a disastrous state. So here you can see what we're going to work with.
I'm just
going to
copy it.
Sure. We're thinking about using something like Joomla.com, which is open source, like a tech WordPress, so when we turn it over to them, it'll be easier for them to edit and update. And see if you can talk about some verbal work to accomplish.
Yeah, we're hoping to make it look a little more professional. And want to
see what the history, it's just elliptical
I have a whole list of teachers that we wanted to add to it. So we have their clients, and they've already spoken to Lee Kim about things they want to volunteer to make a lot better pictures and things.
We also want to add maybe some social networking. So they have accounts on Facebook and MySpace, and thinking about adding blogs for trying to tie in community participation in the website too. It's a really strong group, and they deserve a lot better than that. That's what we're
going to
do.
Next question while the next group sets up. So how are you going to interact with your clients?
Email over the telephone, and asking them to test what we're doing in our management.
So you're not going to have any net meetings or any of those sorts of things? Not for next week.
Our project is called Recipe Republic. It's recipes of the people, for the people, and by the people. And we got to thinking about the different aspects of recipes and recipe websites that are out there, and what we'd like to see as budding young chefs. And so we looked at some of the different attributes that are out there and found out what was lacking. So we decided that we want to build a website that will allow users to submit their own recipes, to rate other unique recipes, and to search for recipes based on unconventional criteria, such as the number of ingredients, the cooking time, whether special utensils are used, and things like that. So we'll be using HTML and PHP and MySQL to build database and interact with it.
Okay, we'll take one question while the next group sets up. You guys got to start asking questions.
Are you accepting recipes
or not? Sure.
Yeah.
Why not?
Why not, you say?
For Glenda's book club. This is Glenda and Sarah, not Elizabeth. And we're actually going to be coming up with a name for that book club as well. It's not going to be called Glenda's book club. There are Glenn people in it. So, and we're going to have the kind of content we're going to have on there is some background information about the book club. We're going to have their book selections for the year with images of the books. And we hope to be able to figure out how to connect that to book reviews on there. And we're going to try to put a calendar of events on there. And this is our real challenge. We're going to try to use Google Maps with API, mashup, whatever the correct term is, to put meeting locations and directions on there so they can find where they're meeting each month to review their book. And possibly also something where we can, if you like, they like the certain genre of the month, then click to a list of other books in that same genre that they might like to read. So we'll be using HTML, JavaScript, and Google Maps.
And we'll take one question from that group. You guys are on roll. Somebody ask a question?
Well, first, somebody will ask you a question?
Yes.
Okay. Marissa, Laura, and I have mynotredame.com. The public relations department at the College of Notre Dame have all of these written personal accounts of people's experiences at the College of Notre Dame. We want to take those experiences and within some type of email and media format. We want to allow users to submit their own personal accounts about their time at the College of Notre Dame in text or multimedia files. And just to make sure that what's put, what's submitted is legit, we want to figure out some way to regulate what can or cannot be submitted to mynotredamestory.com. What would you see on the screen? Personal stories include certain categories, maybe as a couple of examples, current students, alumni, faculty, and staff. Some instructions on that, how to submit stories, whether it's in person or online, and maybe a comment section or opinions part about the College of Notre Dame story. That could be possibly in a blog format or some way where you can send it to a webmaster. Then finally, the scope, what kinds of limitations there might be, include the types of multimedia used to present stories, whether it's going to be used just in where everybody has to submit by real player or just an audio format as an example. We'll be allowed to submit stories, that's all part of the regulation goal. And finally, the number of story covers who are going to do an audio visual presentation. We're going to be given these accounts, and it's going to be interesting to see how many people we can actually get to come up with something that's multimedia. Thank you.
Notice how these are getting shorter. Question? Question?
Okay, we're going to be working with the Bel Air Mansion and Stables Museum. We're going to be creating a brand new website for that because what they have now is this. It's on the City of Bowie website. They don't have their own, so we're going to plan on making their own. We're going to research and develop some content on the Bel Air Mansion and the Bel Air Stables. They're two separate things. We're going to incorporate digital multimedia, go and take some photographs, possibly a virtual tour, using JavaScript for maps over on foot and their homepage pictures. We talked to the client this morning, and she said that she wants to do both an advertisement and a virtual tour, so meeting client needs is going to be one of our limitations. The website won't be used, so their input is important, but what we need to do is also important. none of us have worked this model, so the virtual tour may be a little more difficult than we expect, and balancing the content and what we need to do with what they're asking for is going to be another challenge. And this is kind of the idea of what we have to plan.
Just to explain to you what it means, well, the next group sets up, the website will not be used?
Because they have it on the CDC website, they said that they're just not going to. They have ideas for our content, but they're not
But can't you just like have an anti-website that
higher
in Google than theirs does? Or it's just a better website? Knock them out of business.
They want to let everybody know that their any images they take and everything are copyrighted by them.
Yeah.
And all that.
Well, she could, because I said we're going to create this website, she said, because you don't have one, and I meant for Bel Air, and she said, oh, we have one, and I'm like, oh, yeah, for the City of Bowie, and so they're not planning to do individual ones for their live media, so they weren't interested in that, but she was very nice, and was like, I'd love to talk with you about it, but meeting with her will not probably physically meeting, because she's going away for several weeks, within the next 2 weeks, because it's spring, and she's going on trips to get stuff with me.
Which happens to be the entire duration of the project.
Exactly.
All right, for us, we all want to do something with books, and particularly with book series and how books are on the list, and sometimes you forget which book you're on, you want to know, and you want a quick reference, and we decided to make a wiki where book lists would be available promptly and easily, and we also wanted to do some of the multimedia, reading a book aloud, obviously, when it's in the public domain. And we do have someone who is a reader who might be a model for us, other than ourselves, so that we have someone to bounce ideas off of and communicate her through email.
Is that it?
Yeah.
I thought there, it looks like there are four pages.
I thought. Oh, wait, we are also on author trivia. We're going to have links related to books. And then each author is going to have an individual author page that you can click on their name when they're in the long list and go into an author page. So you get some more detailed information if you want.
So will this be linked to Fiction Finder at anyway, will this be linked to any other site? OCLC. Fiction Finder is OCLC.
I'm having links for the author pages, but we're still working on what exactly.
So there's some interesting scholarship on how people find fiction. What's your, are you targeting adults?
Yeah, the books that we've chosen so far, it's adults.
Okay. So I can introduce you to a couple of people to talk to about how people look for fiction. Good. Thank you.
We left our presentation online to the table, so we're doing a website about recipes and foods, so we have dumplings, but they're not here. And we need them in this room anyway, so we'll have them probably at the end. Basically, we are doing a website called Food Play, which is about demonstrating recipes that are very tactile and that really need more than just a recipe or a picture in order to demonstrate how to make them. So our client, for us, because the three of us each make a lot of things that when we've had dinner parties, people will say, oh, how do you make those? And it's, well, I can give you the recipe, but unless you're watching me make them, it doesn't really make much sense. So it's people like us, and it was anybody who throws dinner parties, basically, those are people we're aiming for.
And so the way we're going to do that is, surprise, we're going to do a website, and the website's going to utilize HTML and CSS as the main kind of structural elements. But the big thing that we're going to have is multimedia. We're going to shoot video of ourselves and edit the video and put and embed that on the web ourselves so that people can see and hear us as we're making everything. We'll also have some still pictures, and we're thinking about using JavaScript to help us make fancy menus and things like that. That's the other thing. We have sort of a main database of these certain recipes that are very tactile, but we're also building full menus around those particular recipes. So, for example, for dumplings, we're going to teach people how to make dumplings with the visuals, but then also say, well, this is how you put together an entire meal that is leading from the dumplings.
And we're looking for other ideas. We have like six ideas right now. We'd like two or three more ideas of tactile recipes that you would find helpful to have a video of. So if anybody has ideas, go ask them.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry?
Play-Doh.
Oh, I'm really
excited. I think it's Play-Doh. So if anybody has any visual recipes that maybe are made themselves, they know that it really helps to have a visual demonstration, or has something you would like to know how to make, we're definitely open to it.
So are you going to have any disastrous outcomes?
We have a lot of disastrous outcomes.
We're going to have some special features, but we don't want to reveal all of them.
And have you thought about how they train airplane mechanics to fix airplanes by showing them the procedure for doing it in text at the same time?
We're going to have the textual recipes as well.
But I mean, there might be some scholarship on how airplane mechanics learn.
Okay, I thought you meant putting something about airplane
cameras. No, the learning theory, how to use video together with, you know, noise.
We didn't
use
what we will now.
Very good.
We're doing ours on the research day that the iSchool had. And what we're trying to do is recreate the energy and the feel of the research day for the internet, and particularly for potential students and potential faculty members. Of course, we'll be using JavaScript, web design, and who knows, we might even use some smiles. We can find some good video on there and some good audio to go with it. Kind of what I just said. We're going to be looking at when and where events took place, who was speaking, who had a booth, and what their research was or is still. And you know, we can't go back in time, so whatever still exists is what we're going to be using for our audio and video. Except we will be able to interview people who were there, to keep people involved and see what kind of experience they had, pull quotes. And when we put this all together, we hope to recreate the look and feel of not just the event itself, but also the iSchool's homepage, so that if the iSchool wanted to pick it up, they could just port over, you know, one frame of our website into their website's frame for the main content. Any questions?
So is there any reason why you'll just deal with the existing things? Why don't you recreate the experience? Like when they interview people, often they'll then go back and get the interviewer to change the question so that the person's answer is an answer to a different question. You could go and create a research review that never existed.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Anyone, any other ideas?
If you want, I shot it for University Publications, so I can give you all those photos.
Oh, yes, great.
And then Mike Morton, who's the real official photographer, was there, might also be willing to give you photos.
Okay. Yeah. Anyone else? It's already better.
Good. So let me give you a couple of reactions. First, I was not expecting that everybody would already be doing something different. But the Crisis Affair has got this problem that the people using it don't speak French, right? The people using it might not speak French. Or maybe they won't speak French. I don't know. Anyway, you've got this, this sort of multilingual aspect to it. The community theater has got a client that's going to use this right away, Friday. So the Crisis Affair doesn't really have this client that just absolutely has to have it a certain way. There's going to be some process for using this once it exists, but the existence of it might change the way they think. The community theater's got a community theater, and they're actually doing stuff today, and they're still doing it, and you're trying to sort of sync up with them. So there are different sort of dynamics to the different projects. But each of the projects has something really interesting to it. Google Maps API, the masochists who are trying to do the database, the really interesting idea of how do you put user-generated content together with regulation, right? So how do you regulate people's behavior when they are both generating and consuming content? So that's a question that has some pretty serious policy implications. So one of the things that I realized the longer we talked about this is that there is scholarship on almost every aspect of what it is you're working on. So if you're working on a museum website, there's scholarship on how to build museum websites. That lots of people work on this problem, and you don't have to start at the beginning and learn the things they learned the first day. You can learn things nobody yet knows by starting where folks are. And so one of the advantages of doing this in grad school is that you can come to people like me or other faculty around or other grad students that have different experiences. As we talked about earlier, people know where to find things in the research review they have. But you can talk to people about where would I look for how to do something. The research review is trying to create a virtual walkthrough. So you want to have something like the link structure follows the spatial layout. Things have physical context. The human-computer interaction lab had a whole lot of context around it because the way you walked into it, you got the idea that you were in a lab. So what is that lab? what of that context already exists on the web that you can draw in to what you're doing? And what would that context look like for the newer labs, the Center for Information Policy and e-government? The fictional worlds was really interesting because I encountered it in two different places. One was I went to OCLC, and they said, oh, here's our fiction finder, and here's how it works, and here are the technical problems that it has. And I'm looking at that, and I'm like, does anybody use this? And you know how many people use this? You know how many people use Fiction Finder? OCLC's Fiction Finder in a typical day. 10. And so you think, well, why not 10,000, right? How many people are looking for fiction in a typical day? And so look at the Fiction Finder and find out how it works and think about how what you're doing can connect to it, can bring people to it, can help people to start with something that was more local to them and then bring them to the bigger world if they want to. And every one of the things you're doing could take people to a bigger world, not just to the world that you start out having in mind. And the tactile recipe is one I think is just great fun because you can think of it as a recipe site, but if you think of it as a multimedia training site, then you land up thinking about drawing in lots of thinking that people have done about what's really different in this world. So, I mean, literally, they have people that are working on airplanes that are wearing helmet cams, so you can see where they're looking at every point that they do things. And so you might actually do this tactile thing with a little helmet cam. And you get fingership cam.
You even have the red light so you can really
get around with it. Good deal. Okay. Anyway, great fun. So what I would suggest is that you seek to finish your project in 3 weeks because you won't. But you will learn by trying what it will actually take to finish your project. So jump in, think about it as a prototype iteration process. Just go do it. If there are parts you don't know how to do, skip them, come back and do the hard parts later. But get as much of the structure around it as you can, and then get with a client within 2 weeks from now, show them where you are, get their feedback, and then do another 2 week cycle, and a third 2 week cycle, and your third 2 week cycle will be good. Won't be perfect, won't be done, it'll just be good. You'll have learned a lot, and be proud of the results. Okay? Next week, we're having a class on computer-mediated communication. In order to hold up my end of the bargain, I'm going to fly to Tampa and connect with you by Windows Live Messenger to demonstrate the technology. So for the remainder of that course, Yejun will walk you through the issues of computer mediated communication. And then I'll pay you back by joining your class the next day. Again, from Tampa. Or, alternately, you're welcome to come down to Tampa and you can do the class with me. And I'll be back the following. Okay. Thank you all very much. Okay. So I've got one question back up here, you might use certain technology on a scroll for a device, or might slow you down than you want to look on, right? So the reason that I have you click on it is most people who go to that place don't want to see the video, right? But maybe you do want to see the video, so they're all right. So it's a big audience.
The thing is, I wish that I was just friends.